Welcome to the Banking Reinvented podcast. Every week, we discuss how banks can progressively modernize their customer journeys and model business operations around their customers. You're listening to Tim Rutten, and I'll be joined by Backbase CEO and founder Jouk Pleiter and other senior banking leaders from around the globe. Ready to unpack how to re-architect banking together? Let's get started. All right, welcome back, everyone. Thanks for listening again to Banking Reinvented, the podcast for changemakers in banking. And today I'm joined by Stuart Cummins. Stuart, very good to see you in the show. You're the CEO of Nedbank Private Wealth International, and you've been so kind to spend at least 20 to 30 minutes with us to discuss the space that you operate in. Welcome to the show.
No, thanks, Tim. Thanks for inviting me on.
Very happy so, because maybe also for the audience to get a bit of background, I pretty often reach out to different executives in the different regions where we, of course, operate. And in this case, I reached out to Stuart and asked him the question, what do you actually think about Robinhood entering the UK market with their wealth management proposition? What's your view? What's the opinion? Is it relevant to you? Do you actually care? Does it, you know, keep you awake at night, or is it completely irrelevant? So maybe let's start there. That's how we got connected. What was your initial response, Stuart?
Yeah, my initial response was really... You know, new competitors are coming into the UK sort of wealth management and investment management market all of the time. So, of course, any new competitor is interesting, but it's not really where my time and focus is. And I would suggest most people in my position have their minds focused in on their own business and their own clients and how we can make sure that we deliver to them.
That was the first response, and then we got connected. But maybe before we dive in, can you tell me a little bit about Nedbank?
Sure. Nedbank Private Wealth is very much a high net worth wealth management and private banking business. We have offices in the UK, Isle of Man, Jersey, and Dubai. We're part of the Nedbank Group, which is predominantly a South African and African-based bank. But the Nedbank Private Wealth business is typically outside of South Africa, working with clients across the world.
Gotcha. Thanks for the intro. And really good to hear and have you in the show. So maybe to start unpacking the topic, in our initial conversation, you were quite passionately sharing that it's indeed not about focusing about, a Robinhood entering the domain, but it would be more helpful to have the conversation about what hampers the execution. What are the roadblocks to actually transform yourself and make progress? What's the major topic for you to, let's say, double click on in the coming 20 to 30 minutes?
Yeah, so I think the reality is that, you know, if you think about, and I'll focus more here on the wealth management and private banking segment, typically, you know, looking after clients investing more than £500,000, for example. If you look at that as an industry, you know, what we have is a business which has historically not been heavily reliant on technology. Technology has always been part of the answer, but it's now much more important to private banks and wealth managers to be able to harness technology in the right way in order to gain some form of competitive advantage. We have to recognize that we're in a world that's highly volatile. We're in a world where there's lots of new competitors coming into the market. You've also got to accept that there's pressure, downward pressure on margins and costs. You know, costs are generally increasing. So organizations that perhaps historically were more focused in on delivering to their clients through a human level now have to focus in on leveraging technology, not just for things like, you know, digital portals and things like that, but much more around making the business more efficient to keep up with the regulatory change, regulatory demands, and also recognize that our client base of tomorrow is perhaps a little bit different to today. We have going through this process now of this intergenerational transfer of wealth. So lots of wealth managers and private bankers, private banks are having to think differently about technology. And you know that's really the backdrop that defines where we're at right now.
Yeah, and when you say they have to think differently about technology, like prior the view was it's just an enabler. You need a few things here or there, but you know it's not the cornerstone of how we operate. It's like an add-on, it's a tool. Is that a fair assessment?
I would say so. I mean, we have to recognize that there's lots of digital-only banks and there's lots of digital-only investment management businesses, both in the UK, but also globally. You have to accept there's a big part of that market. But as you go up the higher net worth curve, it was maybe only 10 or 15 years ago that the industry was recognizing that it needed to give better digital platforms for clients, better access to their investment portfolios, better investment reporting, things like that, which complemented the human advisor. There's typically in a high net worth, more sophisticated client base, a much greater human element. But now there's a recognition that we need to empower those advisors, the high net worth private bankers, and make them more efficient and make their role easier so they can deliver to their clients effectively and also enable the business to grow as well. So the technology equation, the higher net worth you go up, actually typically reduces. But I think we're now in a position that there's such a challenge to keep up with the changing external environment that organizations like private banks and wealth managers have to think differently about technology and partnering with technology providers. And that as we know, it's a difficult balance. Two, we have to recognize that we're in a highly regulated industry and our clients and clients' confidentiality and data security is absolutely the most important thing to a bank. Of course, it always will be. Unlike, social media providers, if you like, where the currency is your data, in a bank or financial organization, it's absolutely not. Our job is to keep all of that very confidential and secure. So what we are having to think about is, in that highly regulated environment, how do you drive technology change? What are the challenges? Why is it that organizations struggle to get really good execution on technology projects? And what is it that people like me have to do differently now to cope with this backdrop?
Are you willing to share some examples? For instance, you said, how do you drive technology change? And what are the hurdles that you typically come across when you're in your role as the CEO of the institution?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, first of all, you need to make sure that you're creating a really good environment, not just for private bankers, wealth managers, clients, advisors, but you're also a very effective employer of technology talent, cyber talent, data scientists. How you work with a team of coders is very different to how you would deal and work with and create the right environment for high net worth advisors. So, that's one example. So you need to think about what's your employer brand to highly skilled technology talent in the business. Because if you have the best talent in the business from a technology perspective, that's a really important tool in your bag to develop the business. We've been listed now in the Sunday Times Best 100 Companies to Work For, for over 15 years. And we were, just reconfirmed in the listing recently. And that's based on all technical talents that you need to operate a private bank and a wealth manager. But also, if you think about it, in wealth management businesses, generally speaking, you have a much higher cost income ratio than you would do in a large digital only platform. So what that means is you need to be able to invest selectively. You need to make sure that your choice of technology providers is at the highest end of quality, and things like you've considered operational resilience and fallbacks and rollback and all of these things to make sure that your platform is robust and scalable. But also you need to recognize that we're in a world where large technology change in financial services businesses doesn't always go smoothly. You know, we have to recognize that technology projects quite often cost more money than you originally think, and they're going to take longer than you think. And as an industry, we have to get better at that, and we have to make sure that we're able to drive the benefits that we expect from the technology investment that we make. You know, I always look at sort of large technology projects of having sort of three phases. You know, the first phase is optimism. So this is where, you know, you've just picked your supplier, you've decided to make the big capital investment, you're convinced that that is going to deliver all of your wishes and deliver for every single user the best technology platform you'd ever expect. You hire a load of people to run the technology change. It's optimistic. It's positive. There's lots of promises made as to what this is going to mean. That's phase one. You then get into phase two, which is really reality. You know, you suddenly realize the technology providers slightly overemphasized what they're going to deliver. Some of the capabilities that you're expecting, it's going to take longer, or it's not quite what you expected during the requirement stage. So there's this sort of stage two, which is a bit of a dawning reality. And then finally, you have the final stage, which is phase three, which is sort of slightly more stressful, which is where you're coming close to the go live date. You've had to make some choices around scope items, phasing your projects. And, you know, and then typically as well, that people are generally tired towards the end of projects as well. So how you lead, how you pick the right supplier, how you manage that provider, how you maintain the marathon of a large technology change effectively, and how you make sure that you're getting the very, very best out of your people through that technology change are, of course, incredibly important. And that's the leadership challenge, I think, that people in my position really have. And I think that that's evolved quite significantly over the last 10 years, say.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. I recognize a lot of the patterns that I usually hear in these conversations. I think it's also great to hear that you put talent and employer brand on number one versus choose the right technology. And, you know, it's the individuals that are in your organization are driving this day in, day out. Because without those people, there is no organization, right? I think it's a very nice angle. The invest selectively, you mentioned in the previous conversation we had that, let's say, 9 out of 10 euros in total in this industry are spent on regulatory and compliance checks and basically having everything in place as expected. It's a pretty steep number overall.
Yeah, I mean, I would emphasize it's not just sort of regulatory change. It's regulatory change, but it's also mandatory change. And it's the sort of keeping the lights on type of evolution, you know, that so I think, however, you know, the capital that any organization has and that it deploys into technology, you have to recognize that you have a capacity limitation normally. So your ability as an organization to absorb change has a limited funnel. And so you of course have to make sure you prioritize the mandatory change. You have to prioritize the regulatory change. And sometimes what that means is, you know, a much smaller amount of your investment in technology actually is about changing the game, delivering client enhancements, delivering a better capability perhaps to your advisors, or better utilization of data and data models. And that's really the challenge that we've had. I would say that it's in the wealth management area, it's probably an improving rather than a declining position. You know, I think if you think about wealth management in the UK, significant changes over the past 10 years, but the expectation and the bar increases all the time, quite rightly. And therefore technology is usually somewhere in the equation of the answer, whether it's regulatory reporting, whether it's AML, whether it's, you know, data model, advisor productivity, client experience, digital transformation. So yeah, that is the reality. And I think when I talk to my peer group around technology and technology change, it takes quite a lot of time for sometimes new technology to get into the roadmap of broad adoption in the industry. And I think that, you know, that's a balancing act that we need to tread. You've got limited resources, limited capacity. Therefore, you know, how do you utilize that to deliver the best experience?
We didn't speak about AI so far, which typically is in every conversation I have. So it's interesting to get your view, especially because you shared there's margin pressure overall, right? That's just in the nature of the business. We see that in different pockets in the world, but also specifically here, there is margin pressure. So you have to look at your cost to income ratio to selectively invest and choose those programs or technologies where you go deep and basically take the long haul view. At the same time, there's the whole AI wave at this moment in time. And also in wealth management, we tend to hear the conversation on the likes of, hey, a lot of the manual work, a lot of the spreadsheet work, a lot of the preparation work when it comes to preparing insights, preparing portfolio holdings overviews, all those types of nitty-gritty grunt work that typically the analyst does, or maybe even the private banker actually has to do him or herself. There is a degree of automation or AI augmentation possible, if not completely making it agentic over time, like you see those far-reaching visions as well. What's your take? You're the operator. You're actually in the seat. How do you pursue or view this at this moment in time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the impact of AI is going to be significant over the, you know, over the next 10 years, of course. And of course, most businesses are utilizing AI in some shape or form. But I do think that there is more talk about AI than there is actual execution. You know, like game-changing execution. We're not there yet. And I think we have to, again, recognize that it is unlikely that highly regulated businesses will get there first, right? AI is likely to be utilized elsewhere. And the reason for that is, you know, you need to have such a significant level of governance over AI models. You have to consider model risk. You know, you've got to get under the bonnet of understanding how the AI that you choose actually works. You have to have checks and balances in place to ensure that you're not getting inconsistent outcomes that are negatively impacting clients. You've got, other risks, operational risks inherent in utilizing a sort of AI model. So, I was at an event 6 months ago, and I was round a table who were perhaps 10 people, my peer groups, and we were all utilizing AI, but we were all utilizing it to a relatively shallow level. I think there's real caution around the table to recognize that with AI comes opportunity, but with AI also comes new risks. And we need to really understand that. We really need to be able to model it. We need to be mindful of unintended consequences. And also, again, if we think about the higher net worth clients, generally speaking, you're dealing with quite complex emotional topics with groups of people, i.e. family members. AI is never going to replace it can certainly augment, but it's unlikely to replace the human advisor element of relationships like that. So we also have to recognize that it is likely that the digital only banks will typically lead on AI, I'm sure, and the slightly more higher net worth private banks are likely to be relatively cautious. But that's not to say that I'm negative about AI. Absolutely not. I do see that there are opportunities. I do see that there are ways that can make organizations more operationally efficient. If you think about the UK market itself, there's a huge advice gap. Millions and millions of people don't currently receive financial advice. And as a result, they may not be making really good decisions. So AI has the ability to, I don't like using the word democratize, but make advice or good practice more accessible to the majority of people. So I think AI models can do a lot of good. to enable and equip people to make good decisions themselves, which you could argue replaces the advisor. I just don't see that being the case. I think what it will do is it will service a bigger part of the population that currently choose not to obtain advice, perhaps because they perceive it's expensive, it's quite complicated, they don't quite know where to start. AI can be, could potentially be accessible and enable people to make more informed decisions at a much lower cost, which enables them to make some good choices.
I think that's very much the long tail view or the long tail argument, right? You can service your retail or retail plus population with AI at a level like a wealth manager could do potentially to a degree without the human intervention. To a degree that makes it more accessible, gets people more financially well informed, so they make better decisions, which overall is a duty of the bank, I would assume, and typically that's also in the law. Now, coming back to the population that you service, they are, of course, also looking at the rates that they basically pay for your service. You already shared, hey, there's a margin squeeze. We need to be very cognizant of that. Would you, let's say, go bullish in the coming few years and say, hey, we're really going to go for operational efficiency. We're going to leverage AI as a portion of it, but overall, driving efficiency to make sure the margins are healthy and we can actually give back to our clients so we have more competitive rates. Like, is that a wedge to be and remain more competitive, or do you see that differently?
I think, of course, you need to operate as efficiently as you possibly can while still delivering the service that your clients expect. And I think that's the combination that's the right combination. So certainly the way my business operates is very, very human. Very human. No call centers, you know, direct to human, person takes responsibility. You've got private bankers that have worked with you for 10 years that know your kids, you know. So these are the thing. I always talk about it. Think about this, right? So I always think about my wife. If something ever happened to me, who would I want my wife to talk to? Who's she going to go to that will help her? Right? That really matters. That really matters. If you think about your kids, when something happens to you, who do you want your kids to look to? How do you want their experience to be? So they, for me, are much more human questions rather than a technology question. But we have to help our people to be more efficient in what they're doing. And I would say that we're still a bit clunky in some of our operational processes, which, you know, waste time for our people. And, you know, if we can make them more efficient, that means they can spend more time with their clients, which means that they can, you know, improve the service. And that's really where we want to focus. Outside of that, things like payments, settlements, reconciliations, reg reporting, you just want to automate as much of that as possible and for it to be scalable, effective, efficient. And those things, again, are incredibly important. And if you think about, you know, regulators are changing. They're recognizing that regulation is fundamentally a data-driven process. That's a real new development over the past maybe 5 or 6 years. Data-driven, intelligence-led regulation should help the countries in which that regulator operates to be more productive, more focused in on growth, contributing more effectively to economic growth of the countries in which they operate in. So I think that the way that regulators think about technology is changing, not just in data, but also things like the cloud, right? So, you know, regulators will worry about what happens if Amazon Web Services go down and all of the financial institutions in that country are utilizing Amazon Web Services, right? These are new problems. You know, if you have a cybersecurity incident in a bank, how does that work? What tools do the regulators have to get involved and help with that? What are the skills that they need? So, you know, these are the sort of, if you like, the macro developments that are happening. And if anything, that, again, that pace of change is accelerating all the time.
Not sure if you saw the news yesterday, but Microsoft announced their sovereign European cloud. Satya Nadella announced it at the AI Day yesterday here in Amsterdam. And I looked at the LinkedIn queue last night of Satya himself, where he posted this, the PR outing. It wasn't mild. At least the response wasn't very positive, because the cloud that he's proposing is not sovereign. Of course, there's the Cloud Act, given that the government can have access to that data anytime, any moment. So that also relates back to your point on regulation being data-driven. In another conversation, I think it's a few months back, one of the executives said, we're innovating at the pace of the regulator. That's it. That's the constraint that we have. So even if we want to go faster or more ambitious or what have you, we cannot. So basically the whole industry, the whole market is at the pace of the regulator. In some countries, they are incredibly ambitious and they go really fast. I was interviewing last week with Abdul Alabella from Banque Saudi Fransi. And in Saudi Arabia, they are super ambitious from the regulatory and the government perspective, even more ambitious than the bank. Like, they need to keep up. Like, it's completely upside down. It's a really interesting episode maybe to listen to later, also if you're listening in. Coming back to your answer on being superhuman led, I think it's that's your strategic mode, like literally. It's also the conversation we're having with many of the executives in our dialogues. What is your strategic mode long term, the coming 5 to 10 years? Because in a way, with the AI wave and with the current, let's say, technology landscape changing this fast, there will be a moment where the majority of how you service and how you, let's say, streamline your processes is commodity, just like electricity. Like, there's no way to be more efficient than the next wealth manager. You're all the same in that sense over time. So what is then your strategic mode? I guess it very much comes to this deeper human connect, knowing the family members, really looking after their business, their affairs as they progress through life. Which maybe as a final question for today leads me to the other perspective that I heard from another CEO of a wealth firm, I think it's 6 months ago. That his private bankers were complaining to him specifically that they did not have sufficient time to actually be successful with their portfolios, with their clients, because they were just amassed in manual processes, in a lot of paper handling, a lot of, you know, not adding value as much. So that was actually his cue to go to market and evaluate, hey, what are my alternatives to get out of this rut so I don't lose my private bankers, because they can also move on with their Rolodex. Does that resonate with you, or do you see a similar type of pattern in your experience?
It resonates to an extent. I think you have to, however, I sort of think about the medical profession, right? So if you think about the medical profession, if you went to see your doctor or your specialist and you'd had your meeting with your doctor and specialist, and they didn't take really good notes around the meeting that they had with you and what you said to them and what they said to you back, you would worry, right? And if you think about it, in a wealth management or an advice, from an advice perspective, the environment, the regulatory environment, has an expectation that there's certain disciplines that take place in the industry that ensure that there's good documentation, there's a good thought process around the advice that's given, that is documented, that there is a clear articulation back to the client. Now, you can argue that that's admin, right? And that's stopping me going out and meeting a client. I would slightly turn it on its head and say, not really, that's all about your clients. However, do I think that we have made it as easy as possible? Definitely not. So that's where I would definitely agree. And I think we've gone through there's a sort of view that banks need to be run on policies and procedures, which I think we need to rethink that. I think they need to be run on effective workflows. I think policies and procedures are a clunky way of achieving really good governance. Really what we need is thought-provoking and potentially AI-supported workflows that mean that we get consistent outcomes. Again, draw the other comparison that I talked about, for example, which is doctors. If you think about surgeons, one of the ways in which they minimize negative medical outcomes is checklists. It's checklists, it's protocol. I do these things in this order and I don't think about it. I have to go through this process. So somehow we've got to marry the need for effective, repeatable process that delivers good, clear, consistent outcomes for clients versus also creating an environment where the best advisors have flexibility and they use their own style and approach with their clients because they're highly skilled at it. How do you merge those two things together is again, quite an interesting conundrum. And technology is going to be part of that, clearly is going to be part of it. And as I say, I think AI will be part of that equation as well.
Certainly it will be. Now, before we go to the wrap-up, Stuart, what's maybe one thing that you would share with the audience as a key learning or a key insight that you've, let's say, experienced over the past few years? That you would also tell yourself if you could 5 years ago or 10 years ago to maybe, you know, have been more effective or more efficient or maybe have a more enjoyable career at a given moment in time. What's maybe the number one lesson you could share or are willing to share?
So, well, one of the things that I share quite regularly, not just with my management team, but elsewhere, is making sure that you have the right aspiration for the business that you're in. And I talk about institutional elegance, right? The job of a management team is to create institutional elegance. That means that things work in the right order. We make people more effective. We remove barriers. And those words, elegance, are very specifically chosen because it really makes people think, actually, are we elegant in what we're doing? Or are we just pushing sort of inconsistent, process, if you like, into the organization? And I think if there's one thing I keep coming back to is a challenge that I lay out, which is, are we actually becoming more institutionally elegant or not? And how have we factored that into the decisions that we make? I'd encourage all of us to make sure that we're putting our clients more centrally to what we're doing. So, for example, every executive committee meeting I have on a weekly basis, we always have the clients as a key part. And we say, how have we protected our clients? How have we advised them with integrity? Or how have we made their lives easier? And at the end of every ExCo meeting, we challenge ourselves and say, how have we done that today? Because the danger is that management teams become more focused in on the financials and, if you like, the backward-looking metrics and not enough time focused in on the things that really make the difference to your people and your clients. So I think they would be that habit of regular challenging of the executive management team is something that I found quite useful in my team. I've also found pretty useful in making sure that we don't stray too far from that.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing, Stuart. Super interesting insights. All right, then we're going to wrap up the episode. I'll just try to give a few highlights of the conversation. Stuart, we kicked off with my initial outreach, which was about the challengers, the fintechs entering different domains and to a degree trying to eat your lunch with digital-only value propositions that, you know, are pretty well-priced and pretty competitive. Whereas the actual conversation we held was more about what actually really matters to the institution and how do you go through these technology transformations? What are the ingredients that you need? And just to highlight a few, you mentioned, first of all, number one, solid talent and employer branding as a key, let's say, quality or capability in your organization to make sure you have the right people to go on the journey with. And secondarily, you mentioned invest selectively, choose the right partner that you go with. And in a way, it also said go long, like don't go for the quick fixes almost, but really go for a long-term partnership that has high quality in its fibers. And then thirdly, you shared, let's say, the throw of disillusion almost that you go through when you're running a technology project. In the first moment, very optimistic. In the second moment, reality hits. You need to make scope decisions. And then finally, you go for go live. You're actually almost tired of the program, right? It's intense. So picking the right supplier or picking the right partnerships to do the work with and basically go on the marathon with is a key element that you highlighted. Lastly, we discussed a few different angles, the advice gap towards the long tail population, how AI could play into it. But mostly we concluded with a sentence that I really liked from your end. How do we move from policies and procedures to efficient workflows? And how does technology, how does AI, how do your people play into it to really deliver almost remarkable value to your end client and really keep that front and center in your operation? Anything you would highlight or maybe add to wrap up the episode?
No, not particularly. Just to say on the point of the new competitors, I think we have to recognize that that's generally a positive. We have to recognize that I think even if new providers come into the market and have new propositions, that's got to be a good thing, and it's got to be a good thing for the UK PLC or whatever country that you're based within. So I don't think I think we should welcome new competitors into the industry for sure.
Fully agreed. Stuart, thanks so much for spending time with us. Much appreciated. I'm sure the audience appreciated it. If you want to follow Stuart, check out his LinkedIn. So Stuart Cummings. You can also find it in the details of the show notes. Having said that, I would say see you next week. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for listening to Banking Reinvented, a podcast by Backbase. Make sure to follow both Jouk and myself on LinkedIn, where we will be sharing key insights about our journey towards modernizing banking.